listened to the podcast, and I got to say it was very, very enjoyable, a great listen, and I thoroughly enjoyed all of your insight on the place.
Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the latest episode of the El Arpa podcast. Joining me in studio is the wonderful, magnificent, mysterious, maleficent Mary.
It was going well till then.
Until I ran out of M adjectives.
Hmm.
How's it going?
Very well, not as well as you.
Well, I don't know what that means.
Very well. You?
Okay. Our slow decay into bitterness. And bitter rejoinders. I feel like we should be holding a glass of sherry as our partnership goes south very quickly. But we're aging very close, or closer, I should say, to the 100 golden episode, which is falling around Christmas. So I'm very excited about that. For some reason, Blind Boy has like 52 episodes and he's been doing it for like half a year or a year. I think he's been doing the podcast for a year. And we've been doing this for a few years and we've already gotten to this milestone now. But because the last 2 years, though, we have been doing it with a lot more frequency. So I think we will continue this rate of a podcast a week, if not more, you know, special bonus episodes every so often. So we should be on track for, I don't know, the next milestone, 500 podcasts or something. Wouldn't that be nice? It won't take another 4 years to get to the next 100, that's for sure. So cultural things. We're going to talk a lot about culture today, as we do in every episode of the podcast. You are preparing for a conference tomorrow night, and then you're going to be leading tours around the Caixa Forum on, oh, what's that thing you like again? Oh, yes, Egypt.
the only thing I like.
And football. But what can you tell us about this endeavor of yours, this venture?
It's an exhibition about pharaohs, or about the figure of the pharaoh in ancient Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it came from the British Museum. Or at least it was organized by people who are curators there, and then went to Barcelona and was there for a few months, and is just coming to Madrid now until January.
Okay. This conference is just to orientate the guides, no?
Yeah, the conference is by the curator. They usually, just before they open, they explain, you know, how the exhibition is distributed and what it is about, just like a bit of a presentation.
But you have a PhD. Surely you know all of this already.
Yes, I know that already, but it's useful when you're preparing the visit, because if they tell you, you know, the theme areas and the things that they want to emphasize and resources and all that, then it just makes it easier to... It's like going to class, you know, when you're at university, you can learn it, but if you go to class, you sort of like already learn half of it while you're in class.
That's very true. And also, since your parents are paying for it, you better go.
Well, that depends on the student.
Well, a lot of my students who are university students don't seem to go on Fridays in particular, and generally in the mornings ever. So, though I'm the opposite, I prefer morning classes just to, you know, get a nice academic start to the day. So you're going to be leading tours around the Caixa Forum. So you've done this before as well. You took me to this... But the animal metamorphosis people being turned into animals, that was kind of the great theme of that exhibition. You mentioned the pharaohs as well. Mm-hmm. Is this going to be divided into kind of, obviously complementary themes, because it's all an exhibition that tells a unified story. But what are the different components of this exhibition, or do you have to wait till tomorrow night?
I have a rough idea from the press release in Barcelona and the materials that they uploaded for that one. And, well, it's about the different roles that the pharaoh played in ancient Egypt. So not just kind of like a king figure, but also a figure that had to keep the universe order, and there's a very important concept, which is the order of the universe, that the pharaoh has to keep in balance by just doing a series of rituals, as a matter of fact.
Okay, so do they go into sophisticated understandings of the cosmos?
There's a lot of astronomy in ancient Egypt, obviously, and there are a lot of things that... There are a series of life festivals that the king has to do throughout the year to guarantee that everything is going to work out all right in every way, like politically, diplomatically, but also for like the earth in general.
Okay. And obviously, yeah, in ancient societies, you did have a broad, you know, in broadly speaking, you have evidence of astronomy. You know more about this than me. Would Egypt be the leader of the ancient cultures when it comes to astronomical leanings or astronomy leanings?
You know, I wouldn't be able to answer that. But it's just it's a shame, but it's something, it's a subject that is very much associated with all these like esoteric explanations about things that I run away from. So, I mean, there's a lot of like astronomy related to like mathematical concepts and all this. And
okay. Well,
there was definitely like interesting things there, but some of them were not entirely sure like what they meant.
On the Stephen Colbert show, he had an astronomer on from, I think, Yale University, talking about how they were able to measure things Einstein was talking about almost 100 years ago. Mm. Or more, I think that's what he said. Yeah, it was almost a century ago, measuring gravitational waves and all these interesting things. And I was very impressed because they went into a quite detailed explanation. So they didn't try and dumb it down. They said, look, this is what it is. And I'm sure you're all capable of following the explanation. But they did do one interesting thing as well, which was they can convert a lot of these things into sound waves. So they play the sound of two black holes colliding. Can you imagine what that sound would be like?
Explosive?
It was literally like this. It was like,
really?
Yeah, it was like a very quick,
very fast
thing. But he said, and you know, fair enough. Of course, I think he is right that understanding it orally as well will be another part in the future of understanding the things that we can't even see in the universe and how these things are being measured is tremendously interesting. So I would recommend as well checking out that clip if you get a chance. It's on YouTube. It's been uploaded maybe a week ago. Speaking of the astronomy and also the observatory, we have a video on YouTube that you can check out, which also plugs our blog. And you also can listen to our podcast from maybe, I don't know, a month ago? Or maybe a month and a half ago, where we... Interstellar, where we talk about some of the movies that we saw in the observatory there.
Yeah,
so podcast. Yeah, so if you're interested in that kind of stuff, you can check out that other podcast. So you mentioned a press conference. You know what a press conference is called in the footballing world?
No.
A presser.
Is it?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know.
When I was writing for Marca, and then they're like, Enda, you have to cover the presser. I was like, are you talking about? But yeah, so like another thing is like we'll expand more on the blog in part three, but there is also an article on John Aldridge, who was the first foreign player play for Real Sociedad in some 30 or 40 years. You were alive at this time.
30, 40 years? Well, specify. Not 30 or 40.
Not 40 years ago, but he came in 1989.
Yeah, you were alive too, you know.
I was two, yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't remember John Lovitch.
I was two and a bit.
But like... All right then, whatever. Anyway, based on, because I've seen the old clips, so on YouTube is a fantastic resource because you can find like a lot of the contemporary match reports and interviews with the players. So they kind of cut between the action on the pitch and then interviewing the managers and the players and referees and everything as well. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of get a real contemporary understanding of what was happening then game by game. In the famous words of Cholo Simeone, we have to take everything game by game. But yeah, it's seemingly though, he was someone who... you know, he fell in love with the Basque country and they fell in love with him in San Sebastian because he took Spanish lessons 3 times a week. He really fitted in with the local culture. He liked talking to people, eating and drinking and all that stuff. And also he was given a stake by a butcher for every goal he scored. So he played 75 times for Real Sociedad, 40 goals in those appearances. Nice thing, so he got 40 T-bone steaks. Because after he came, two English players came, two English footballers also came over. And one of them got a block of cheese every time he scored a goal.
Really?
And the other guy, I can't remember exactly what he got, but I couldn't find any more evidence of him, his relationship with that food product. But the guy with the cheese, one day, a journalist for one of the local papers saw him throwing the cheese out of his Ferrari. So,
oh, no.
Which isn't very nice, no. But they call him Senior Goal because he was a prolific goal scorer. And I wrote an article about this, which is on the blog and also can be found on LaLigaBlog.com. Because he was a key part of the Liverpool team, and he was a born and bred Scouser and Liverpudlian, but for some reason when they sold him, nobody else came in for him. So it's like one of the mysteries of that era. Like, what? It's like Messi, not as good as Messi obviously, but like a really good player, you know, and nobody else wants to buy him, so it's very strange.
But he wasn't old.
He was like 20. Well, he finished when he was 31. He's there for 2 years, so he was 28, 29 when he came over.
Well,
especially back then as well, when you didn't have the technology and the food and the yoga and these understandings, and you're drinking between games. So career is like, you know, you're not like Maldini where you can go on for until you're 37 or 38 or whatever. But one more thing I'll say about this is that basically, he was so beloved there, but when he first came, it was quite negative because, as I said, he was one of the first foreigners to play for Sociedad. So in that sense, when his first day in the training ground, he saw graffiti scrawled over one of the walls saying "foreigners not welcome." And in another infamous incident, one fan spat in the ground and crossed the street when he came across him in the city as well, of Donostia. So it just kind of shows how, you know, those barriers in just a short time and just through goal scoring and having a smile on your face were very quickly diluted by his bonhomie, by his great character as well. So I would recommend checking out that story. Not only is it a footballing story, but I think it's also a human story and also a reflection of Spain and the Basque country at a particular moment in time as well. But apart from that, he also scored against Barca, Real Madrid as well. So some great moments there as well. But, you know, hashtag not a football podcast. So and so much so is it not a football podcast. We'll be devoting the majority of part two to a photographic exhibition, as is our wont. So please, you know, in the interlude, make a cup of tea, come back and listen. That's a crumpling of paper there. Part two of the show. Murray, I'm going to ask you a very simple black and white and question. Okay. It's not open-ended. Okay. What is photography?
Well, that's an easy question to...
Don't worry. I'm just messing. Don't worry. I don't expect you to answer that. But what does Mr.
Terre,
Ricard Terre, wonder has he ever been to Senadore? Richard Terre, what does he believe photography is? Ricardo.
Well, I think he thinks it should be about that universal essence. So like things that, not individuals, just the individuals are just a means of getting through to shared emotions and things shared by the whole world.
Okay, well, that's interesting because I think we had a difference of opinion about this exhibition, not in terms of whether we liked it or not, because we both liked it, but in terms of how we felt, you know, in different ways, how he managed to fulfill this mission statement, which, you know, it was... Every photographer's mission statement should define how we look at the photographs, because another photographer could have the same image, but because his focus is different, it automatically changes the meaning of the photograph, which is interesting because, like, a lot of what we consider art or something of cultural value is informed by kind of the perceptions of the people doing it, you know? I mean, there's a famous example, well, recently Banksy, for example, go on a small tangent before we come back to old Richie here, of his painting or his picture, you know, that got shredded at the auction house. But there's also a similar story I heard recently in a BBC article where some famous painter gave another painter his, like, a sketching, and that the painter who received it just rubbed it out with an eraser and a pencil and wrote the words, "This formerly here, a picture by this famous artist." It's a very recent BBC article, so as always, because I'm missing the names there, sorry about that. You can go check it out. It's still there, probably on their webpage. And then it was framed and put in an exhibition so people can go and see it, because it's been culturally informed by this deletion and also this other sentence being put there, how art can change, and also imagining what could have been there as well. I mean, it's all this kind of diffuse things, but him doing that is, you know, radically changed, or, you know, should radically change your perception of the piece, or what is there now and what was there before. And in the same way, you know, it's not just like something to prepare you or warm you up for a photographic exhibition when you see these words. I mean, this is the philosophical underpinning. This is crucial to understanding the image and photography in the exhibition. So it's very important. It's a significant thing if you do like the photographs, but maybe you don't see the mission coming true. I think, you know, maybe it's not that important for some people, but for me, I think it's a big emptiness, or it's a big rupture in the experience. If even if you like the photographs, you can't kind of wrap your head around or see the text that explains the underpinning of the photography, if you can't see that coming true in the vision or in the exhibition, for example. That sounds very long-winded and complicated. I don't know if that made sense.
No, that makes sense.
That makes
sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes the writing is distracting. You know, if the writing, most of the writing doesn't normally add anything to things.
Yeah, but I think in photography exhibitions, so it does, because normally photography isn't pointless. We've seen some bad exhibitions of photography, but normally it's not like modern art where a lot of it is quite poor. In my opinion, at least. It's not a generalization, because, like, Jesus, like, a lot of it is bad, you know. But, like, photography, generally, we've seen a lot of photographic exhibitions, and like, some have been bad in terms of, like, okay, they're reaching for something that just isn't there in the image. And I don't think it's possible to capture, but generally, the text, I think, is very, very useful for framing the concept or what we're going to see, you know. So okay, so we set up basically the kind of idea here. Do you remember anything else from the explanation that was important for the artists or for the people going to see it?
Well, I think that was the most important thing, was this thing that we mentioned about the essence. But but I think another interesting thing is the time that is that the photographs were taken at. And it's kind of like the post-war Spain. So we're talking mainly about the 50s. But then he has another kind of period, which is more 80s and onwards. But the funny thing is that those images are mostly atemporal, and you can see some of the 50s mixed with some of the really recent ones, and you wouldn't be able to tell, like, when each one was taken.
Well, that is one key point, because he even has photographs from the 90s and the 2000s, and you wouldn't know. And even ones from Santiago, Chile, and Barcelona or Portugal. And in most exhibitions, they are divided by time periods, or they're divided by location, sort of, like, you know, Portugal ones or whatever. But these are all kind of mixed together. So in that aspect, I can see the universality of all these things coming true, because they're all mixed together. But also as well, you wouldn't genuinely know, because the photographs look beautiful and rich and in monochrome, black and white. And they, you know, the ones from the 60s and the 50s don't look any worse than the ones from the 2000s or the 90s. And those ones are generally good quality as well. So in that aspect, you know, you can see the universality coming true. Now, also, he was a very human photographer. So we'll say about a lot of nice things about him as well. Because, you know, because we saw a video of him as well, a 70-minute one at the end of the of the exhibition, and he does come across like a very lovely man. but there's one particular story that I think is interesting, and you can tell us about that as well. And you know the one I'm on about, no?
Yes, yeah, the story. Well, some of the photos that that are in the exhibition are of people that were in some like sort of home for people with like mental illnesses, and it was quite interesting because I mean we've seen all the people, we've seen all the pictures of like disabled people, and it takes someone special or someone like very skilled to take those photos in a way that is not, you know, like patronizing or too sweet or sort of like feeling sorry for them or whatever. And these photos, I just thought like they were nice because they were natural and, you know, they were fun and just like any other photograph and very human. So that was nice. And then when we went to see the video, he explained that another photo, well, he came to do these photos because another photo that I'd taken previously, which was from a girl that was in First Communion, but she was cross-eyed, basically. Somebody saw the picture and said that they had a son that had Down syndrome and would he take his picture and so on. And then he said he would do it if this person, who was actually a doctor, fixed the cross-eyed problem that the girl had. And he did, and so everybody was happy and lots of pictures were taken as a result, so it was quite a human story.
Yeah, because you described in the first part of the video how you have to have technique or a very specific way of approaching photographs. It's not just enough to go out willy-nilly in a way and just like snap anything. But also he reveals some insights in terms of you go to a place like a plaza and you could be there for hours, or even he recalled one incident where like within maybe 20 minutes he had some fantastic photographs as well. So photography is such an interesting blend of timing and also the technique that you want to bring to it or impose on the art form, but also the great humanity there as well, which is you know, very evident in that kind of story. And speaking of the photographs, generally, yeah, you mentioned the Holy Communion. There are of a religious aspect. You have funeral themes, kind of altar boy themes, Holy Communions. They're like the predominant image or the predominant images in the podcast. Not the podcast. I'm very tired today. The exhibition. So, do you recall any images that kind of jump out for you that would be very interesting, you know, that you thought were just beautiful photographs?
There was one, for example, of a kid that was just playing with a wheel, which is something that kids used to do a lot in Spain in the 50s, no, when there was no toys and before. And well, it's just nice because it sort of like captures the like a derelict building in the background, and the kid is just moving so fast with the wheel that it's just blurry. It's quite nice because it's kind of plays with like the building like being there all the time, but then you know it's a bit like it's post-war Spain. So it's like derelict and all a bit like gloomy.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, there's like this kid going so fast that you can barely see him. And you can just see that he's playing and he's kind of like oblivious to the surroundings.
Yeah, I think that's the one example in the series, really, of a hint or a suggestion of another world, some interior world or... Well, no, not. I don't think it's the only suggestion of an interior world, but of a fantastical world or an imaginative world, because a lot of photographs are quite... bleak, and what I think, you know, the magic in the photographs that are there is that he captures that look in a crowd. He described in the video about how he liked taking pictures before things happen, the anticipation of something happening, and that is, I think, the root of like a lot of great photography, because it's just the in-between moments, as he described himself. And where we differ in the kind of universality things, I would, you know, I think a lot of photographs, okay, now that I'm thinking about it more and we're talking about it, I can kind of see how they can represent universal things. But I think what he does find very often as well as the individual in these group settings or these cultural settings or these things that are recognizable, you know, a Catholic scene, anybody in Spain or Ireland will be able to recognize that dynamic straight away. It's just so obvious. And it's, you know, it takes a lot of skill to bring it, you know, to represent that moment with fidelity and make it seem alive, you know, like it's still happening in front of your eyes, because you can understand that relationship between the protagonists straight away. So there's a lot of skill in that as well. But I think what he does do, you know, you mentioned the wheel, it is like a hint of another world. But what he's finding here is that kind of moment of magic in this world, or that spark of personality or individuality in these social structures. And predominantly in that time period, these would be Catholic church related structures as well. I don't know if you agree with that.
The individuality mention was interesting, because, well, I think I told you when we were there, I think the individual aspect there is just a channel, no? Like when he picks on a little kid or somebody who's, well, a lot of them are like, he focuses quite a lot on children, to be fair.
Yeah.
And how they're in situations of like rituals or festivals or things that are like collective events.
Yeah.
And I think in that case in particular, I don't know, the children are just like channels of like explanations of a situation or a feeling that could happen elsewhere. So there's a dimension where you're looking at a child and then you're thinking, well, this is a child that is taking part in this event and has always been involved with it through his family, but he doesn't really understand what it means, or he's scared, or, you know, or he's bored. And those are things that can be like extrapolated to any culture. Yeah. But at the same time, for a person from that culture, like, for example, in this case, for me, or for you through the association with like Catholic culture, I don't know, you're looking at things and you're kind of like really recognizing certain moments, and you're even like seeing yourself as, for example, as the children that are lost in that moment and kind of like not understanding very well what they have to do. And I think that was like a really valuable aspect of it, that when I was looking at it, it was very easy. I mean, I'm quite cynical when it comes to like the exhibitions, and a lot of like photographic exhibitions don't, I look at the pictures and they don't say anything to me. Mm-hmm. But with these ones, the thing that I found interesting was that they you kind of like would see the sequence. You kind of, it's almost as if like there was sound to them. Like that was how they felt to me.
Yeah.
You know? Because you could get a feel of what the surrounding moment was.
Are you suffering from synesthesia?
I don't know. I was quite surprised, pleasantly surprised, you know, because like it was the first photographic exhibition that spoke to me in quite a long time. So that was quite nice.
Well, I think it's probably what it is a little bit of both. Well, it's probably more your understanding of it, because it's more in line with the photographer and he has the final say what the photograph should be, in a sense, even though it is subjective and you can impart your own meaning to it. I would say of the series, the photographs that maybe represented that more were the funeral ones, because mm-hmm. what you saw were shadows and icons and symbols and gravestones and these things. So the artifices of the funeral procession rather than the actual people, even though they did make an appearance in some of the funeral photographs. So I think there you have this kind of thing, because at one point he's standing over a grave in Chile, and you see a shadow and it's just a grave. And again, it's a moment that is universal, truly universal, because I think we can all recognize that across cultures. In terms of the other ones, the other photographs that we've been talking about, I think, okay, a lot of what you're saying is true. And again, that's based on what the photographer is saying as well. So it has a lot of merit to it. So Mary has a lot of merit there. but I think as well, what you have is like, I think, to achieve that fully, you would need more crowd scenes to really hammer that home. Because what I'm finding here, and I'll explain the photographs in detail here as well to support this, is that you're finding, again, as I said before, the individual moment. Because, you know, if you're thinking of collective joy and these religious experiences that you're sharing with people, like I imagine, you know, if you're in the middle of one of these processions in Spain during Easter, you're carrying the Virgin Mary on this huge kind of platform, you're going to be kind of looking down, you know. If you're in that crowd, you're going to be looking at the Virgin. So a lot of things, like, even though you're surrounded by a lot of people, you're not really taking notice of the individual. And that, in a sense, that's what collective joy is, because we all become one in a way and have this experience, and that kind of strengthens social bonds, you know, across cultures and across history. So in a lot of ways, even though you're surrounded by all these people and all these details, you don't actually see them because you're blinded by the collectiveness of what you're doing. If you're carrying the thing, you're focused on carrying it, and you're all you can see is the back of someone's head or their legs as they walk in front of you. And if you're in the crowd, you're probably watching the Virgin Mary and all these things. But there's one picture here where it's for example, there's one of a little girl carrying the cross like Jesus, very intense eyes. You know, I think that, you know, we're not looking at the crucifix scene anymore. We're looking at this individual who has a lot of character in her face, for example. Another one. There's one also of people carrying crosses in this procession. Two crosses kind of intermingle and create a natural frame. Within that frame, you can see the face of a girl who looks pensive. Our eyes are naturally drawn to that because those two crosses come together and create like a wooden structure, like a frame. No, so for me, what we're seeing here is just the glimpses of humanity in these wider structures. And again, this is universal as well, because okay, we don't have processions in Ireland, but we can recognize the Catholic iconography as well. Maybe the ones I love the most was of the altar boy, who, like, I think the priest is talking to him. He looks very like shocked. He doesn't know what's going on, which I think is very human, because he's probably so young, you know, he can't understand everything. But that's when these ideas are inculcated and they try and get to them, you know, like you do the Holy Communion, do the confirmation. And then even before you're kind of age, you've been baptized, you've gone through these other two processes of the church as well. This one is also this photograph I'm looking at now. We disagreed with at the exhibition as well. and we might use this as well as the cover photo for the podcast, maybe, I don't know. But it's basically three women talking, gossiping, and then like their backs to the camera, and then like this 4-year-old girl maybe behind them, but her face is facing towards the camera, you know. So for me, like, that's the most obvious example of the individual in this thing. But of course, it's against the justification of the exhibition from the artist himself. So, you know, I'm probably reading it incorrectly, but it just seems so obvious to me that, like, not only, like, yes, you can argue it's universal, but it's also focused squarely on the individual. So that's my thoughts on it anyway, on this particular photograph. I know you have something to say anyway in contrast to that.
Well, it's definitely focusing on an individual, but I mean, in reality, we're saying the same, but what I'm saying is that, okay, other than that picture that you've just passed, which is the one that you just spoke about, of the girl with the cross and all that. That in particular, for example, like, is this girl like looking, is very intense and all this. That, I think, is focused on the individual, and there mostly what I see is that girl, you know, and the characteristics of that girl. But in the other one that you were talking about, what I see is like a kid, little kid playing with, you know, his doll or her doll, being like oblivious to what is happening. And also like in their own little world when there is an event and then the kid is just at the back minding his or her own business. And in that case, for example, that's how I feel that although the focus of the photo is the kid is just like a tool to show a situation that many people can feel familiar with.
We can all pick and choose photographs to support our arguments. But
No, the other one is the only one. Actually, like, I forgot to mention that to you. It's the only one where I thought that that didn't apply. And the way it focused on the girl kind of like undermined this universal purpose, because I couldn't see anything else, anything beyond the fact that it was just a, you know, pretty little girl or whatever.
Okay, well, I'll give you one photograph in return then. Well, there's one from Barcelona in 1956 of a man selling religious icons, and there, those icons, those pictures, I should say, of the Virgin Mary are to the foreground, and he's kind of blending into the background. So he is, you know, it's a black and white photograph, he's not moving, so he's almost blending into the stone structure. So in that sense, he is almost becoming one with the church in a physical sense. So, and that, you know, you can see really here the blending of the human and the stone structure and that kind of thing. So I give you that photograph being an obvious example of universality. Excuse me, I am going to burp. I think that's the Holy Spirit moving between me. But there's also other photographs that kind of like are also absurd in a way. Like there's one here of just someone looking out like a train window with no context, and it seems
I don't remember having seen that.
It seems almost farcical. There's a few other ones here as well, like a little boy over. Like, this is from this is like 98 from Portugal, or 1992 actually from and yeah, so he looks like completely lost in the sea of like mourners as well. And also this crazy one, which is like of a boy holding his head in his hand while he supports himself in a stone wall. And he's just looking at a donkey as well. So like again, like, there's kind of like touch of the absurd and the surreal here as well, which are also like very specific moments. I don't know.
That one, I think like he was worried because he sort of like had to jump and he was worried in case the donkey went for him.
Maybe, yeah. I think we see a picture of the same girl again, but later on in the procession where she looks a bit angry as well. So she's like a very strong character in her features, you know. She definitely tells a story in her face. So I don't know. What was that intake of breath for?
No, because like, yeah, I suppose some of them are like harder to know what the exact, I mean, oh, there's always like pictures obviously that speak more to us than others.
Possibly. Well, I think it's an important series because obviously it documents a part of Spain that is still here in a sense. I mean, you have processions and things like that. You still have funerals and people burying people. But I guess as well, it's of a poorer Spain, pre-European Union Spain, pre-modern Spain as well. So it's a historical testament. But again, as well, I think it's fair to say there's a lot of humanity as well in the photograph. So that's always like the most important thing as well, if you can bring the humanity, tell a humane story in an art form. So yeah, all in all, even though we kind of disagree with how the subject was transmitted, I think it is an excellent photographic series, which is in, where is it again?
Fundación Canal, well, not... In Rio Rosas.
If you're in Madrid, you know.
Yes.
But if you're not in Madrid and you...
Yeah, because all the times we've been to Fundación Canal, the biggest one is in Plaza de Castilla, but this is like a smaller version.
Okay, I think... What's the comisaria?
Laura Terré, I'm assuming, is his daughter.
Yeah, but what job is this?
Yeah. The curator.
The curator. Okay, so the creator of the exhibition is probably his daughter.
Yeah.
So very much a family affair. So yeah, so if you are not in Madrid, but you'd like to see these photographs, which we both recommend, his name is Ricard Terré.
That's right.
So it's R-I-C-A-R-D for the first name, then T-E-R-R, and then finally E with a tilde, little accent over it, for the family name as well. So he's a Catalan, no?
Yeah, he's Catalan.
Yeah, so that's a Catalan name. Mm-hmm. All right then, well, that is that for part two, I think. Anything else you want to say?
No.
All right then, well, I'll have the pleasure of your company in part three. So, welcome back to part three of the show. Thank you very much for joining us.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. We've been here in the studio for hours, so I've got a bit cracked. But the blog, you've been enjoying the blog, haven't you?
Yeah, I have very much.
not biased there whatsoever. But just so you remember, it's called The Irish Slice of Madrid. And you can find it on wordpress.com, where we tackle a lot of cultural, historical, and even some sporting stories. Which is also going to be very interesting is we know a lot of people who have connections to Spain, a lot of Irish people, either they've lived here and have gone home or they've met Spanish partners in Ireland. So they have experienced Spain through them, but also by coming on holiday here and you know, absorbing some of the local culture. But also one of the boys, his grandfather fought in the Spanish Civil War. I haven't contacted him yet, but if he can tell that story, I think it could be pretty interesting. The other ones will be also researching topics of historical interest, but maybe someone will also write something personal as well to give a bit of balance or variety to the stuff that we have on the blog. We have stuff about John Aldrich, also some poetry there, a short story about the language barriers, a story about the mythology and the connections between North Spain and Ireland.
Harps.
And harps as well, which we spoke about in last week's podcast as well. So we'll be doing a lot more. I think in next week's, one of the articles that might be up when you listen to this, we're going to look at the Irish connection to the Spanish Civil War in alternative ways. So there's kind of evidence of Irish people in the Civil War through maybe resources that you wouldn't expect to find them in. So I think that, and then by finding them there, I think that tells it like a very interesting story as well. So we'll expand more on that when we get the chance, when we're doing the next podcast perhaps we can delve more into it, but also as well when it's up on the blog, of course you can read that story in detail. But any other stories that you would like to write that has whetted your appetite? You mentioned one to me there at the weekends.
Yes, about the names of names of animals, and in particular of birds in Irish. We've talked about it before in some podcasts, and it's interesting because the names have the translation is kind of like characteristics or like funny things about those animals, and they also, some of them like give them kind of like, not supernatural powers, but you know, they attribute sort of like human roles to them and things like that.
In fact, you tweeted this recently. So if my voice seemed distant there for a second, it's because I was getting my computer. Because on our blog, we also have our Twitter feed integrated into it. So, for example, it's not there.
I am putting you on Twitter, but yes, I know what you mean. We retweeted, about
the screeching owl or something like that.
Yes. Let's find it.
Yeah. Okay, so 1 second.
Yeah, it was like we retweeted something.
Here it is. Stupid computer. Oh my god. Okay, so words of the day. Shkragog Kila. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that properly.
Well, certainly better than me, that's for sure.
Literally, screecher of the woods. Irish name for the jay. The jay's scientific name is Garrulus glandarius, meaning babbler of the acorns. A single jay can cache up to 5,000 acorns in an autumn, hiding them in tree bark, earth, or leaf litter. Okay, that's interesting.
This is something we retweeted. This author actually talks a lot about the origin of words, not only like in Irish, in other languages.
Oh, really?
And some of the stuff he talks about is really interesting because then he also asked when it's names that have been put by people through observation. So then he normally asks like, what's this called in other languages? And then it's very nice because sometimes the same thing is called, the same animal is called the same thing in different languages. Which is an explanation based on observation, like, for example, screecher of the woods. You know?
Well, it's interesting because screecher of the woods and babbler of the acorns, the latter being the Latin one and the first one being the Irish one.
Yeah.
It's not the same, but it's definitely two concepts related. And also, the Latin one meaning babbler of the acorns, you always assume the Latin one is going to be the scientific name. But it's not. And garrulus is a word we have in English as well.
And in Spanish.
Yeah, garruloso, no, or something.
Garrulo, but in Spanish it means like a country bumpkin, basically.
If someone's speaking like in a garrulous way, it would also be kind of like, we wouldn't always associate with a country bumpkin, but in the sense of it's like rough and it's not eloquent. It's it's not clear. It's not, you know, it's not poetry basically coming out of the mouth. So... All right, then. Well, it's named Robert McFarlane on Twitter if you want to see more of that stuff. Also, check out Irish Archaeology, which we've also been pushing on this podcast, but this Twitter feed, because they have some amazing photographs of Ireland, even in contemporary senses from the 20s, I think this. Yeah, from 1913.
Mm-hmm.
There's some photographs here. But anyway, so yeah, you can find us as well at alapramedia.com is our website, alapra1 on Twitter. LARPA Media on YouTube and LARPA on Instagram. All variations of the same name. You can find us on Patreon as well. And Mrs. Radio Republic. Radio Public.
there was, I was asleep. Sooty was asleep. Radio Public.
So can you just explain a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, you can listen to a podcast on any platform that you want, or pretty much on any platform of your choice. But if you listen on Radio Public, that helped us a little bit. And
certainly will. Okay, well.
Be nice.
So that draws another episode of the LARPA podcast to a close. Thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate those listens. And we'll be back next week with another award-winning, well, soon-to-be award-winning podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The LARPA podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.